You want to know what I remember about you from college? Nobody ever gave you any shit. You didn't take shit from anybody.
You know what else? I hate what I do. You know, the money's good, but I swear to God, I hate putting phony teeth on phony people. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm a dentist, and when people need it, that's great. I feel for them. But some assholes, I just want to slap them in the head and say, get your ass out on the street, you know? There's a lot worse things to worry about than your teeth. So what's going on with this kitchen remodeling thing? What's up with that?
What else could you do besides veneers?
No, don't change the subject. What's going on with that? Come on, tell me. What's up with the kitchen thing? Tell me.
The last time I spoke to Doreen, she was at the airport in Boston. She wanted to talk to me about the kitchen remodel that she and the girls wanted to do, and I was busy running out the door. And I fucking snapped at her. Oh, man, the last time I fucking spoke to her, I hated kitchen talk.
I think you could have let that go, Charlie. I'm sure you said a lot of nice shit to her before then, man. It's one thing, man. Just let it go.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Are you going to be all right, Charlie? You're going to make it, right?
I'm more worried about you, Johnson. I'm more worried about you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. I'm one of your curators, Devin Decker, and joining me, my partner curator in this ever-expanding journey into the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler, Mr. Sejun Sarawik. Sejun?
Thank you, Devin, and I am going to be honest up front about this. Tonight's episode is a little on the heavy side, and I do not know how long I'm going to be able to keep this bit up in honor of kind of the subject matter of the evening tonight.
So let me just say then that there is a bit of a disclaimer before this episode. Trigger warning, I think is how you actually say it. I'm dropping the veneer now because this is a serious moment here. In Covering Rain Over Me, Adam Sandler's first film of 2007. This is what he released in March before he's like, I now need to be pronounced Truckin' Larry over the summer. This film really deals with a lot of heavy topics. Heavy topics that, like, most people would say you should avoid those on your semi-comedic film history podcast looking at the work of Adam Sandler. But we are in season four, and season four
nowhere to hide
is for the fans.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of those films that constantly was brought up as something people wanted us to look into, examine as part of this journey was Rain Over Me. And honestly, I mean, getting the first impressions right out of the way, I totally get it. I mean, like, there's a 10% chance those people were assholes and trying to sabotage us.
Yeah.
I'll even, like, knock that down to 7% chance, because BJ Novak wasn't one of them.
Oh, never mind, you're right. Back down to 10.
So it's, like, maybe only a 7% trying to sabotage us. But other than that, this is a movie that I think if you saw it when it was new, when it was, like, when you could really feel it, right? Like, honestly, sitting in the shadow of the events of 9/11/2001 and all of the themes of grief and loss and everything that this film explores,
yeah,
this is a powerful film. This is definitely a powerful film in 2007, and I still think it's kind of a powerful film in 2022 when we're watching it for the show.
Yeah.
But it is just be aware that there's a suicide attempt in this movie.
Yeah, so to kind of piggyback on some of the stuff that Dev has talked about, for those of you that are even just slightly aware of the film Rain Over Me, it is Adam Sandler's 9/11 film, right? Like, that is what it's pretty much known for. But more to Tevin's point, there's actually so much more going on in this movie, especially in terms of possible triggers and things that will affect people, that it surprises you, because you're kind of prepping yourself, right, for the 9/11 parts, and those parts still hit hard. What you're not prepared for are all of the other things that go into this movie. I mean, there's conversations and depictions of attempts at suicide. There's all of this stuff going on about familial relations falling apart, and for reasons that are not just the obvious ones in the film. Like, there's a ton going on here. There's conversations that border on almost abuse in some places. It's just there is so much going on in this movie beyond the 9/11 talk, that the 9/11 talk, when like it throws you, because you're so guarded in this one area, that when the other stuff comes up, it cuts deep.
So just keep that in mind as you go on this journey with us in this month's episode. We are releasing it on September 9th, Adam Sandler's birthday, but that just so happens to be 2 days before what will be the 21st anniversary of those events that happened in September 2001. So if it's too much for you, I'm certainly not going to be offended. I don't think Season will be offended if you need to step away from this episode.
Yep.
But it's one that comes up all the time. People talk about this movie, and I can also think of all these reasons not about this wonderful performance that Adam like produces from this script, but also all of the like flowery little other bits that help build out the world of Reign Over Me, mm-hmm. that I think are just so instantly like magnetic. Like, you're so attracted to the world that's on display. Honestly, one of the reasons that people could be coming up to us saying you should do Reign Over Me is because we covered High Fidelity, and there's a lot of High Fidelity in this movie.
There is some of that, for sure. I mean, because of the ways in which music is explored as a way to express the self, right, and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, I also want to say that one of the other reasons that it gets brought up a lot and was thought about a lot is that it caught slack, and still to this day, because films of this genre always do, of being something equivalent of trauma porn, right? Especially in 2007, not 6 years after the events of what happened. Like, a lot of people don't want to relive that sort of stuff, right? But I think what separates it from something like, I will give an example of what I consider to be too far, would be Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, right? I think that film focuses in a way and uses the events of September 11th in a way that borders on inappropriate in so many moments that it's hard to watch, right? And so I do think that there is a conversation around this film regarding that. Now, whether or not you know where you fall on that argument is not the right word, but debate is, but like, where you fall on that depends entirely on you know, what you know about the movie, have you seen the movie, and even then, how you feel about the events and how they're handled, right? Because I think that what separates this from something like Extremely Loud is that not everybody in this movie is suffering because of the events of 9/11, whereas that's the entire point of Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, right? Instead, in this movie, you have people that are dealing with all sorts of different trauma, and what it is they're constantly brought up against this beast that is the trauma that Charlie suffers from 9/11. And it's weird because it's not a game of whose trauma is worse. It's quite the opposite. It's an explanation, and almost like it's almost like this film is trying to give everybody permission to grieve again about anything else, right? Like because this one man in this world is grieving so much because of this event, it kind of gives all of the other characters permission to then grieve about their own shit, and it's beautiful in that way. And I think that is where it sounds like you fall, Devin, where I fall on it. But again, this is kind of a decision that you kind of have to make for yourself. This is such a touchy subject. It's going to be a lot of that sort of stuff tonight, right? Like, this is definitely one that I feel people should watch. I am enjoyed I watched it, but just be warned that I'm not guaranteeing you're going to come out of it enjoying your time with it.
I will sum up. We're going to get a lot of references from my mother on this one, and I apologize for that up top, but I asked her to watch this film because, you know, it's also Labor Day week of this, and we had all planned to try to watch it on Labor Day, and with the rains and all of the insanity that happened on the East Coast, we just didn't get to watch it as a family. But my mother and father watched it today, and they got to give first impressions of it. And the one that is still ringing in my mind, and the one that I do want to impart on you, the listener, is it's worth a watch at least one time. Maybe it's not going to be the Adam Sandler movie you go to all the time when you want to see Adam Sandler do something, but it is definitely worth a watch. I mean, just for the performances that everybody has on display in this movie.
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing that we need to talk about with this film is my other big impression about this movie, having rewatched it, is I didn't remember how big of an ensemble piece this movie really is. You know, I too, to the years that have passed, kind of lost the whole threads that go on in this movie that have nothing to do with Sandler, right? Like, there's the ensemble of this film is stellar, and it really is an ensemble piece with a phenomenal lead at the top. And I'm going to tell you right now, I don't consider it Sandler. Cheadle, as the lead of this film, like, carries all of these different threads, connects them all in such a beautiful way that it becomes this like anthology of grief and the ways in which we all handle different forms of it and like what causes it and how things can escalate it and help it. You know, like there's all sorts of stuff that goes on in this movie all held together with Cheadle at the center. That being said, I am going to concede that this is definitely a Sandler film. I'm not going to sit here and argue that I wouldn't consider this an Adam Sandler film, because he is like the untitled titular character of this film that clearly is like the protagonist of all of these events. Don Cheadle very much serves as kind of an audience XP, right?
He's Horatio. If we want to get Shakespearean on this, he's Horatio to Adam Sandler's Hamlet.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which is interesting. And that's something I think we're going to debate as we get a little deeper into this movie and we talk about some of the trivia that I found about it. But let's start, now that we've gotten all of that out of the way, that completely necessary, opening statement before we talk about Rain Over Me on the show. Mm-hmm. Let's establish what we're doing here, what the Adam Sandler cinematic universe is. Sijin and I, what we do is we usually do another podcast called The Say Report, and that's a show about everything. And in 2019, was that when Hubie Halloween came out?
Oh, God, why are you doing this to me now?
No, it was 2020. It was 2020. Hubie Halloween came out, and we did an episode discussing Hubie Halloween and joking about the Screen Rant article about there being an interconnected universe between all of the Adam Sandler films. And that caught fire. That hit the right people's ears, and they asked us why we're not doing that. If we think we have the definitive answer to that, if we're going to laugh at what Screen Rant has to say, why don't we put our mics where our money is and record a podcast about the Adam Sandler cinematic universe?
Those fools. They thought it would be a special, but here it is, an entire other series.
That's in its fourth season, and honestly, something that I know I look forward to each week. And right now, as I said, we are in season four, so we are doing all of these for the fans. These are all inspired by things that fans have asked us to look into. So far, we've studied Big Daddy, which was, I'm so glad we did that Big Daddy episode because it has freed up a lot of my time. Because I'm not constantly being mobbed on the street saying, when are you going to do Big Daddy? And then we did You Don't Mess with the Zohan, which I guess nature abhors a vacuum. So without being able to say Big Daddy, Zohan was the next one. But this one, Rain Over Me, is one that I've been getting chirped at about or asked about since the very beginning. And I think partially like that's because of something like Uncut Gems, which comes out at the beginning of 2020. And everybody is suddenly talking about Adam Sandler like he's God's gift to acting. Can you imagine that he's doing a performance like this? And for some people, the answer is, well, yeah, I saw Rain Over Me in 2007.
Yeah.
This isn't a surprise to me. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the movie. We're going to apply it against our own commandments of what does or does not determine a film belongs as part of our personal shared Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And hopefully we're able to have some laughs along the way in this episode that I really liked, Anthology of Grief.
Yeah.
That is Rain Over Me.
You're welcome. That's Southland Tales, really. But so we're gonna take a look at this film and see how it fits into the giant, the larger oeuvre of the entire universe, and talk a little bit about, you know, where this movie comes from, why it hits the way it does for us, and why it probably hits the way it does for everybody else. But in order to do that, we should probably talk about the way that it hit, huh?
Yeah, this film, what this feels like to me is this is Adam Sandler trying to do a serious movie, and then when it does less than he was expecting, he goes and releases two balls-to-the-wall comedies and a family film in Bedtime Stories. That feels like the response to Reign Over Me. I want to be proven wrong with the facts and figures.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a response so much as just a realization. Like, I don't think that the performance of Reign Over Me, which actually doesn't do terrible. I mean, so it's a So it's a $20 million film, which is not huge, right? Yeah. Like, and in its opening weekend, it makes 7.5, right? It doesn't do great, but it doesn't like top the charts. But it also, I mean, that's pretty well on its way to making its money back, especially once you consider things like we're going to put this out internationally, probably, maybe not. I mean, it is a 9/11 film, which gets kind of weird when you start talking about like international politics. Just in that, like, telling the rest of the world what happened here is not really what the rest of the world wants to be doing at that time either, right? Yeah. Never mind, you know, as this movie teaches us, we're all dealing with our own personal grief in some ways. Like, having other people shoved in our face is not always the best, like, the healthiest habit, right? But then on top of that, you know, we always talk about Hollywood budgeting and the idea being that what they made is not necessarily what they're going to claim they made on it. But by the time it ends its run, it only makes about $19 million, right? So it doesn't quite hit the $20 million budget. Once you add international, it passes and all of that, so it's fine. But it does not quite hit its budget. So to your point, like, the idea being that it does not perform extremely well definitely could be something that he takes to heart in some ways. However, like, critically, it does pretty phenomenally. Like, it across the board fires on some pretty hard cylinders. You know, some people are like 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10. I was not expecting this from Sandler, but it's still Adam Sandler on screen, is the attitude of a lot of those ones. But then there's some other places that are giving it some straight up like 9 out of 10s and things like that, 5 stars, because it's hitting an emotional place that everybody can kind of get on board with. As I mentioned, there is definitely also a small faction of people out there that feel like it's taking advantage of or using like 9/11 as a prop in a film, and it is, but it's doing it, I think, in like with all best intentions, right? I don't think that there's a malicious thought behind this movie of, you know, this is the time to strike while the iron's hot and everybody's still sad. I don't think that's the real attitude behind this film at all. But yeah, it definitely catches some heat for that as well. So with all of that in mind, I mean, when it opens up against, of all movies, TMNT.
Yeah, that was my exact thought about this film. Is Reign Over Me is a film that I had not watched before yesterday. I watched it for the very first time September 6, 2022.
Yeah.
And it's not like I wasn't going to the movies in March. Yeah. At the beginning of March, I went and I saw 300 four times. And this weekend, when Reign Over Me was in theaters, I saw TMNT four times. So,
yeah,
I was going to the movies. It's just this film did not appeal to me. And I think part of the reason why this didn't appeal to me, and maybe I'm completely sticking my foot in my mouth at this point, is that Robert Downey Jr. Jamie Foxx movie that came out.
Oh, The Soloist.
Yeah.
To be mentioned later in the episode, but yes, okay. Yeah.
It gave me real The Soloist vibes. And I was still working at the movie store at the time, and that film, I was hearing nothing. People didn't really have good things to say about it.
About The Soloist?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
that understandable, but it was just one of those things where the common man was kind of directing me away from seeing The Soloist. So then when I see Reign Over Me, that same sort of feeling kind of penetrated my mind.
Yeah, well, the soloist had one very big key feature that reigned over me, interestingly, because of some back and forth in the casting, doesn't end up suffering from. But the soloist had a lot of White Savior vibes to it, like rightly so. It was a somewhat true story, like based on a technically at the time, the guy was always a Latin American writer, is the like writer that's based on, played by Robert Downey Jr. I may be getting that wrong, but I do remember that. I do think I remember that being a huge part of it. But then the whole big thing is, at the end of the day, you have Robert Downey Jr. saving a black man, if like a black homeless man, played by Jamie Foxx, right? Jamie Foxx, who also has caught some slack in his life for some of the decisions that he's made about playing characters such as this, but has always stood by those decisions. Like, I mean, even when it came down to some people giving him shit for being in Ray and stuff like that, and a man that's no stranger to trauma porn, let me put it that way, the term, I mean, not the actual act of, because I don't consider it that, but if I haven't made that clear, but like the idea being that like that movie kind of has a weird a weird kind of aura around it, right? So comparing this movie to that is a totally fair thing in the vagueness of it. But when you look at the specifics of why the soloist kind of catches the heat it does, and then try and apply that to this movie, it falls apart pretty quick. So I'm sorry that happened to you, because I can totally see where those comparisons would have come from, but like I wish that you had watched it anyway, because you would have realized that was not what was going on.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just one of those things that it never happened until I was forced to for this show, and I'm not upset. I was very excited to watch this film because of the things that I had heard. It's just one of those things that, you know, I don't really have the time to watch the 9/11 Adam Sandler
exactly.
Movie.
How do you come back to it, right? Yeah. You don't watch it in the moment when, like, everybody is watching it because it just came out. This is a hard movie to come back to later, right? And I found that same kind of feeling with Uncut Gems, but I'm glad that I did when I went back to that, as I admitted in that episode, I have the same thing here. I found it hard to come back to this film when I did. I will say that for me, it was probably a few years ago when I finally watched this movie. And like, it was one of those things where I had seen clips online. So like, I had some general idea about characters and stuff, thought I pretty much had an understanding of the movie. Also, it was about 9/11, didn't really want to watch it. The end was that was my main feelings on this movie, up until finally, I don't know why, I got a wild hair at my ass and just started watching criers, like looking for movies that were definitely guaranteed to like hit you emotionally, right? Just trying to feel again. No, I don't know what I was doing. But like, I was going through this thing where I was watching these kinds of movies that were guaranteed to hit. And this was one that would come up continuously. It was a gap in my Adam Sandler watching. I recognized that even then. So like, I watched it and it hit. And then instantly started just forgetting things about this film. If there's anything that I could critique this film in, it's that so much is kind of thrown in to try and catch like the concept, that the concept sticks and the larger story of Charlie and Alan sticks. But a lot of that beautiful side stuff that you've mentioned so much, it doesn't have staying power like the main story does, which is unfortunate, because like there is a lot of good work going on in that stuff. It's just, it's cannon fodder for the plot and the point of this film, right? This movie is such a movie with a point that it kind of loses, like kind of the edges get a little fuzzy.
Yes, that is
loses focus.
Perfect
is, I think,
way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait till we get a little bit deeper into it. So are there any other facts and figures? Or you think,
I mean, we should talk a little bit about the casting, just because like you kind of hinted at it, and it is kind of why this movie kind of almost doesn't get made, then gets made, then almost doesn't get made since 9/11, right? So Mike Binder, who wrote and directed this film, also appears in it in actually quite a few scenes. I was surprised to see him show up once, and then suddenly he was in like a lot of it. It is a 9/11 movie. He wants to make this movie, and originally attached is Tom Cruise. And when I first read that, I considered the idea of him in the Don Cheadle role, but apparently that's not the case. Apparently he was supposed to play Charlie, and like this idea being that he liked it but walked away for some reason. You know, it's kind of up in the air. This stuff happens all the time. Actors leave for that, but I can't help but feel that the reason he walked away was that it felt a little bit like he would just be flipping the script on Rain Man, right? Again, another movie that I'm probably going to
come up later.
Yeah. But, like, that must be why, right? Like, I'm not going to put words in the guy's mouth, but it feels like if there was a reason for Tom Cruise to kind of be like, no, I should distance this one, it's got to be Rain Man. And so he ends up disappearing from the project. Javier Bardem is originally on it, apparently is the reason that Sandler even gets mentioned in the room with Mike Binder, because he really loved the work that Sandler had done in Punch Drunk Love. And that's how we end up with Sandler. And then Don Cheadle is just luck of the draw, I guess. I don't really know what happened there. But yeah,
that is one of the greatest mysteries of Hollywood, is how Don Cheadle wound up. I mean, it really feels like it might be a P.T. Anderson thing.
Yeah, because of Boogie Nights, right? Yeah. Isn't that the big, like, yep, draw there? Yeah, I mean, maybe.
Or
maybe,
Crash. Maybe. I mean, this movie, it releases in March, so it'd be weird if it was trying to be Oscar baity. But no, there's definitely a scene in this movie where he goes, "Hey, Oscar," and Oscar waves at him. And in my notes, I wrote, well, that felt Oscar baity, right? Like, that felt weird. And that was before I knew that it released in March of 2007.
Against maybe it was waving TMNT. At Oscar season, passing it by.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I mean, like, I think that that's also something to point out. Don Cheadle is not as big of a mystery if you consider where Don Cheadle is in his career at this moment, right? You've got the Ocean's movies, you've got Crash, you've got, you know, a couple of years from now, he's going to be taking over a major role in a Marvel franchise. Yeah, I mean, there's Don Cheadle is hot right now, so it's not surprising that he's, like, working. It's just of all of the scripts for him to really dive into, and as I said earlier, like, really kind of carry this film. Yeah. Like, he does some work, and it makes you realize why he was and is still, like, hot shit.
I mean, I'm just gonna say it. Hotel Rwanda was the movie I thought of as I was driving home, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's why Don Cheadle is in Rain Over Me.
Yeah.
Right. This was what he was doing when he wasn't having fun with the Ocean's movies.
What's the Showtime series he did where he led all of the was that it? Lie to Me? No, yep. Lie to Me is
no
the,
Lie to Me is the House of Lies. Yeah.
House of Lies. Yeah.
Well, you need to understand that the first thing that I was thinking of was Black Monday, which is the other Showtime series he did that is very similar to House of Lies.
Yeah.
In terms of it's mostly improvisation on his part. So yeah, it makes sense. But the reason why I would have to argue with you about this not being an Adam Sandler film is the way that it is written, right? I interpreted the same bit of information the same exact way that you did, is Tom Cruise was attached to lead. And for me, I'm like, well, the lead of this movie is Don Cheadle. Don Cheadle is who we see in the beginning. It's who we hang a lot of the story beats on. And then as I'm reading through and I'm like, oh wait, but Javier Bardem was replaced by Don Cheadle. Tom Cruise is going to be Charlie?
Yeah.
That seems strange. And it also seems strange to think of Charlie as the lead. I mean, he's kind of a MacGuffin in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, there was literally a moment in the beginning of this film as I was rewatching it where I thought, wait a minute, does it turn out that Charlie's not real in the end?
Oh my god, I thought the same thing!
I had this weird moment where I was like, I saw this movie, but I, for the life of me, couldn't tell you whether or not he's real or not.
When he was talking to Liv Tyler, Liv Tyler's in this movie, by the way, and she next year is going to be an Incredible Hulk. There's a lot of Marvel connection to this movie, too. Hopefully I'm not stealing from later on in this episode. But, like, those two are top names, but a lot of, like, other people in this movie wind up in Marvel movies and TV shows. Mm-hmm. Like, this might be the first MCU film. I don't know. I'm like, Mike Binder might have been the guy. But it is, like, when he's first talking to Liv Tyler, he's like, I have this friend. And I'm like, oh my god, Charlie is the friend. Charlie is, and he's leaving the hardware store because he's going to try to repair Don Cheadle's broken life.
Yeah, no, it's not that whimsical. Just to point out some other movies that are out around this time, as Devin mentioned, 300 had come out, right? A few weeks earlier, it came out at the beginning of March. I was thinking it was a February release, but no, that's...
No, it's weird that it and TMNT, Imaji's two films, both released in March of 2007.
Wild Hogs is out at this time. The movie that I was seeing with TMNT that weekend, I guarantee you, was Dead Silence. the really weird doll
Yeah.
like fucking movie from the guys that made Saw. I actually really liked that movie. But Ghost Rider had been out for almost a month at this point, and like Zodiac was out there, speaking of RDJ. Like this is the Night at the Museum. Like this is the atmosphere, right? Like this is what's going on, and this is what people have been sitting through for the last few months when they decide to or not to go to Reign Over Me.
A lot of New York movies in there,
Yeah.
come to find out.
I mean, a lot of New York movies all the time, man. Shooter was the other big one that came out that week.
Yeah.
We should mention that, right?
Bob Lee Swagger. That's his
Oh,
name.
man.
Yeah. Cool. That's, wow, that is, yeah, this is a strange time for Adam Sandler. Like, Adam Sandler usually is very good at finding the time to release the movie. And this movie, I mean, everything about Reign Over Me feels ahead of its time. This feels like it kind of launches in the weirdest way possible, and I'm sorry for saying this, the like buddy co like romantic comedy things like I Love You Man. Like, there's a scene from this movie that feels like it was lifted and put into I Love You Man. There
Well, I
is
think part of that is because I mean, we're really getting into some borrowed and blue stuff here,
Okay, so
but
what
like but I will say that part of that is because Binder very much goes out of his way to try and make this film as genreless as possible. There are moments where you are terrified one second because of the behavior of Charlie and then in love with him the next, laughing along with Alan in one scene and then pissed at him the next. Like there's never a moment where you can be sure what's going to happen next because you don't know the genre you're sitting in. So you don't know the rules
And the
as you're watching
score does not help.
it. And
All right. So then let's get to the synopsis so that we can hopefully move into Borrowed Blue before we cannibalize the entire section of the episode. Alan Johnson is trapped, unhappy at his job, bored at home, and generally looking for something to shake up his mundane existence. One day, while driving home from work, he sees his college roommate, Charlie Fineman, walking out of a hardware store and attempts and fails to catch his attention. When he mentions the encounter to his wife and children over dinner that night, a somber pallor falls over the room as his oldest daughter, Sherry, asks if he was the one whose family was on the plane. Alan confirms that he was, and life goes on, same as it ever was. A few weeks, puzzles, and photography classes later, Alan finds a means of escape from the monotony when Sherry needs a last-minute ride to a friend's home for a sleepover. After dropping her off, he again sees Charlie, and this time is able to chase him down. But when face-to-face with him, Charlie fails to remember him. Undeterred, Alan attempts to reconnect with his former roommate, learning that after Charlie lost his family in the plane crash, his life has become very solitary, mostly spent in the now empty apartment where he spends the majority of his time constantly remodeling his kitchen or playing Shadow of the Colossus on his PlayStation 2, with all of the memories of his former life packed away in boxes in a back room. While Charlie is alone physically, Alan has been feeling alone mentally. Sprinkle on some college nostalgia, and you have the makings of a beautiful friendship. In no time, the two are thick as thieves, but soon, Alan realizes that Charlie is prone to outbursts of violence whenever he is reminded about the life he had before losing his wife and children. Alan is able to work around the subject, but when his father passes away while he is attending a Mel Brooks marathon with Charlie, instead of getting support from his friend, all Charlie wants to do is deny it happened and continue with their plans. Alan walks away, mostly in disbelief at Charlie's reaction, but also understanding that there is no way Charlie can be the friend he needs while he continues to deny what happened to his family. After Charlie comes to Alan's home and apologizes for his actions that night, Alan decides that he will make it his mission to help Charlie get the psychiatric help he needs. Eventually, Charlie is able to tell Alan about his family and what it was like when he lost them on September 11th, 2001. While Alan and Charlie's doctor consider this progress, it turns out that there are reasons Charlie has chosen to forget his wife and daughters, and he spirals out into a depression that culminates in his attempted suicide by cop. Now the district attorney is involved and wants to have Charlie committed to a mental institution, leaving Charlie in a legal battle to defend his right to grieve his own way and hopefully find peace. You there, Siege?
Yeah, sorry, was muted and in all of that, I just couldn't bring myself to unmute. Yeah, so as we mentioned, some pretty heavy stuff, right? And the stuff that goes on with Charlie is just kind of the tip of the iceberg and what's going on in the rest of this movie. Because as you mentioned in the synopsis, there's also a lot going on with Alan and in his own life, trying to figure out where he is and what he's doing. And then, as I mentioned, like, he's confronted by this guy that has lost everything, right? And it really kind of – it forces him to reevaluate kind of the stuff that he's been, like – I don't want to say whining about in his life, but he's been dealing with in maybe kind of the inappropriate ways. Let's put it that way, because nobody can argue with that, right? Like, he's not been dealing with what's been going on in his own life well. Whether or not that's big shit or small shit, he at least recognizes that whatever it is, he's not doing it right. And it becomes this kind of journey for him to start fixing some stuff as well. Add into that, like, we have a character of a patient of Alan's, because they're both dentists. I'm sorry if you mentioned that. I don't think I mentioned
dental school. I just said college roommate. Like...
Yeah, but that's why they know each other, right? They were both college roommates in dental school. So one of Alan's patients is making inappropriate advances towards him and admits a lot of her own stuff that she's dealing with.
Yeah.
Alan is also, constantly bombarded by people around him that just can't keep their shit together. It's interesting to watch the other people in this movie, right, and the ways in which they interact with him. The Tillmans, Templemans. Thank you. Yeah. The in-laws of Charlie that you know are trying their best to take care of him, but they're grieving in their own way because of the loss of their daughter and grandchildren, right? Like, and so they're not necessarily doing all the right things either. So I fell in love with Charlie's landlord there.
Adele Modell, the landlord from hell.
Who, like, so clearly, like, cared about him, like Charlie, and took care of him. There's a lot of people in this movie that are just, like, dealing with shit, right? And that's what this whole movie is about dealing with shit and how we deal with shit and what happens when other people's shit is bigger than our shit. Like, it's interesting, right? Like, it's worth considering. It's not stuff we always want to think about, right? So what makes a person want to do this movie, right? And apparently Sandler at first didn't, right? Like, read the script and was like, this is a phenomenal character, but I just don't think this is a Sandler movie, right? But then not only does he end up making it, but ends up, like, producing it under one of his
Well, we'll get there, don't worry, because Madison 23 is gonna mean something.
But this is, there's a ton going on here.
Yeah, it is. The thing that I understood the most, right? I don't try to put myself into the headspace of Adam Sandler when he's picking these movies often, but needing a second read of this script before deciding to do it makes so much sense to me. Because, like you said, on first pass, this movie is just a crier. This is a movie that is sort of genetically engineered in a lab to get an emotional reaction from you.
Yeah, Oscar bait, right? Yeah. Like that's the definite feeling of this script for sure.
And the first time through, all of those moments where I was supposed to cry, I was crying. But the one that specifically hit me on the second time through is when Alan finds out about his dad passing away. And Charlie's response to that is to just go on, where he's like, I'm sorry about that. You want to go get breakfast?
Yeah.
There's this hardware store. I wanted to show you these faucets. And Alan is so, like, flabbergasted by that. And on first pass, like, all I'm doing is feeling bad for Alan losing his father, right? And it's been, like, kind of hinted at that his dad was sick. There's one scene with him. So, like, that pallor is there. Like, it exists in the film. It doesn't come from nowhere. But it still hits on, like, the heels of them losing their shit at a Mel Brooks marathon, right? Yeah, yeah. Like, one of the happiest moments we ever see either Alan and Charlie in this entire film is when they're watching that Mel Brooks, and, like, Charlie's whole, we don't want to waste this Mel energy, right? We're so energized right now. And the way that I saw it the second time through is, in this film that is just a litany of grief and sorrow and having to deal with your own baggage in these horrifying situations, what I saw there was, just because you're going through something, that doesn't necessarily mean the world is going to stop. Like, the world still goes on around you.
Yeah.
And that the symbolism of just that one scene, I'm like, this is a powerful moment in this movie.
Well, and what's crazier is that there is this initial reaction of how shitty Charlie is being in that moment because of what's just happened to Alan, right? But then you're very quick to remember what's going on with Charlie, and remembering his circumstances, you suddenly are looking at how he's behaving in a different light. Consider that like applied to the real world, and how often we have to look at like the ways that our friends react when we're in trouble. And like, you think the definition of a friend is the person that will drop everything to help you when you're in trouble, and that one time they don't do it, you start to question whether or not they're friends with you, right? And that clearly is something that happens with Alan in that moment with Charlie. But after spending more time with Charlie later, coming to the realization that just because he behaved in that way in that moment does not mean he's not a person that cares about him. They are still friends by the end of this film, right? And it becomes this real like layered moment, as you're talking about. One of the layers that I didn't think about the first time I was watching this, but then realized it as I was watching it the second time, is the guilt that Alan must be feeling. Because we learn in that one scene that you mentioned earlier that he has brought his parents to the city to live in this apartment. We're not really given like the full story there, to my knowledge, to my
No, it
recollection.
is the only thing that really sticks out about that scene to me is that his mother is yelling about his father being mean to her, but both of them are still watching Wheel of Fortune. Like, it is just like this beautiful bit of world building that, like, even though I'm mad at your dad right now, we're not gonna watch Wheel.
We're not gonna not watch the wheel. So but you get that whole spiel from his dad about how he hates the city, can't believe you brought me here, I hate this city is making me sick, like all of this. And then his father passes on. So that moment, he has to, no matter how unreasonable it is, be feeling that moment of realization of like, shit, he kept telling me that this city was making him sick, was killing him, and now here he is, he's dead. Did I really kill my father? Like, that whole layer there, just not even really what you consider the first time you're watching it, because you're so like just
You're punched in the gut
bored
by
by the way Charlie is acting, right? Like, it's there's so much going on in all of these moments in this movie. Written so yeah so I mentioned that it's written by Mike Bender, right? Like, and so like, just to talk a little bit more about who that dude is, like, he goes on to, or before this, wrote The Upside of Anger, right? That's that really weird Costner film. I say weird, I don't mean weird, I mean not my kind of movie.
You could call it weird. It's kind of weird. It's like, it's not, it's, it, I wouldn't call it like experimental or art house, but it is definitely, weird is a pretty fine adjective to hang on that film.
He also ends up writing an episode of and becoming a consulting producer for a handful of episodes on Mom. Later on is like the other only other big thing that I really know him
The
for.
one thing that I caught as I was looking through everything that he did is Black and White, which is another Kevin Costner film. And really leans
And
into
remember,
that
black
white
or
savior
white.
thing.
Black, right, yes. Another one of those based on a true story, so we can get away with creating this white savior in this black world. Man, fucking forgot about that one. Costner must love his shit. So these are the kinds of movies that Bender is like writing. This is the kind of material that he's in, right? Like, in these, it's so watching Rain Over Me, like seeing these layers of subtlety and all of this stuff, really makes me want to reconsider my opinion on some of his other work, I guess.
That's an interesting thing to say because this film, for me, felt like filmmaking 101. It felt like introduction to filmmaking. It felt so rote, so by the book. Like some of the transitions, or just some of the ways that things ended up connecting or resolving. Like,
Well, so maybe that's what it is, right? Is maybe this movie is not succeeding at breaking new ground in any way, but what it's succeeding at is just doing the old stuff well, right?
Right, and that could be it, but it is, there are just moments and there are other moments in this movie where
But to point
like
out somebody else that did that and got away with it and was celebrated in this very film is Mel Brooks. So God, I love the man, but the jokes he told were definitely jokes he'd been telling for years.
Yes, that's I don't know, it's just like, but then there's like legitimate moments where like something on scene will like brought me to tears. That moment with the traffic lights. When they go from green to yellow to red to just, and it's all of them down the entire like New York City street, every single light in sync changing, and it just being symbolic of Charlie showing up to therapy, ready to talk, then initially becoming hesitant, and then just stopping it cold. is just like, that was glorious.
Well, and, you know, so you can point to Mike Binder, the director, in those moments, but also, you know, there are many people that make a movie, right?
So right. Maybe so, that's so not maybe cinematography or something like that. I don't know anything about the cinematographer on this film. That's a very good point. It's something that I had wanted to look into, but, like, it's dissolves or it's ways that things are cut to and from, or it just, like, the movie just felt so safe. Sure. In all of the ways, like the filmmaking, which is an interesting dichotomy against it talking about some really fucking heavy shit, right? Like, here's some safe visuals and things that, like, you're okay with, and what we're going to be talking about is not that.
Creating a safe space in order to explore a dark topic is, like, definitely filmmaking 101, though, right? Yeah. Like, to your point. Yeah, I guess I'm not so blown away by that, because I'd rather watch somebody play by the rules well than play Calvin Ball and fuck it up, right? Like,
yeah,
like,
that's
looking
a very
at other
good point.
Right? Like there are ways that you tell tragedy stories like this not as well as this movie does. So I think that's where I'm kind of giving it a lot more credit, and maybe too much credit. I don't know.
I mean, something that I don't want to tear this movie down because, oh my God, he went with, like, this is all first pass filmmaking stuff. It's just one of those things that whenever it does happen, and I can think of, like, four distinct moments where it just occurred, and I'm just like, man, that pulled me out of it. Like, you had me invested in this story, and then because you relied on such a tropey thing in filmmaking, it just, I'm out, and you're gonna have to pull me back in.
To really round out the kind of person that Mike Binder is, a lot of the movies that he produces and or writes, he also very happily puts his face on screen for.
Yes.
He is definitely that kind of filmmaker, right? And, you know, you could say the same thing about Quentin Tarantino, so take this
or
for what
Kevin
you will.
Or Kevin Smith.
Right. But he is the kind of guy, right, but whereas you could point out Kevin Smith and Tarantino, like, pushing, like, the envelope in certain places and raising the bar for certain filmmakers, Binder's not doing that.
No.
Right? Which kind of puts him in a lot with the same camp with the reasons that we celebrate Sandler, right? Is he's a guy that clearly likes, like, making movies and clearly likes being there as movies are being made. And, like, all the power to him that he figured out a way in life to do that kind of shit that he is very happy to be doing. But for anybody out there that has not seen the movie and is just curious, like, more about this guy, or has seen the movie and is more curious about this, he's the guy that plays Sugarman. And he is very happy to produce a film and put his face, like, on screen for it. And
yeah, that is, and that's something where as soon as I saw his name as an actor, I'm like, oh yeah, Mike Binder, he does do that. Like, I knew
my
the name.
My favorite is fucking Blank Man. Do you remember that old, like, Wayne's Brothers movie?
I do,
from back
and
in
that
the day?
Was one of the other things that, like, hearing about the Javier Bardem of it all, I'm like, oh, that's interesting, because I would have thought somehow Blank Man got these two in a room together.
Yeah.
The really crazy thing about it is that Mike Binder and Adam Sandler haven't worked together before or after this film.
Yeah.
Now, again, that's probably because it doesn't do gangbusters. It doesn't even make back its budget domestically. But it's one of those situations where you talk about how they both kind of understand how to serve up that comfort movie.
Yeah.
And it's strange to me. Like, I figured that going back, these two must have done at least one other project together. But for this to be their only time collaborating was a real surprise.
I don't know if it means anything, but it's worth pointing out just the only movie. So we hear the name Sugarman later in Sandler's career, right?
Yep, that is Stan the last Sugarman name. In Hustle.
That is the last name of his character in Hustle. So it's interesting to me that there is, like, this weird echo of Rain Over Me later in that film. And we'll talk more about that. I think we need to get into some old New Bottle
so
Blue, man.
So the last thing that I want to say before that is one other shot that is just absolutely glorious is when Don Cheadle is walking through his apartment to the bathroom, and that final shot from the bathroom, seeing just how far Charlie is from him, bathed in the glow of the shadow of the Colossi, is another just shot that I'm just like, that is glorious framing and just light composition. And so there are those moments. I don't want you to think that I'm just piling crap upon this movie because of those, like, semi-rote filmmaking moments, but those do exist, and they took me out of the film, and that's all I have to say about that. But Siegen's right. It's time for everybody's favorite section of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Something new, something old, something borrowed, and something blue. And Siegen, I found out the end of the phrase.
Oh, yeah.
Stick a sixpence in the bride's shoe.
In the bride's shoe. Got it.
Yeah. So I don't want to say I already bought you one of your birthday presents, but I already bought you one of your birthday presents.
We didn't talk about this on air, right?
No, we talked about that there. Yeah, it's just we've been using the new old borrowed blue. It makes sense. Adam Sandler, he's done a lot of wedding movies.
Yeah, I just, I for the life of me, couldn't remember the end of that poem. And for a hot second, really convinced myself it was stick a halfpenny up the groom. So yeah. There you go.
That'd be something, right? Probably, like, sterilizes him or something. Or, like, it makes baby making easier. But, yeah, so what we do here, what we do in New Old Bar Blue when we're not being blue ourselves, I think I figured it out, Siegen,
hey.
Is we talk about something. If this film, right now we're playing a little bit of a game of what if, where if Rain Over Me is part of our Adam Sandler cinematic universe, what is something new that it is bringing to the party? What is something old that already existed in the ASCU that is sort of hanging its hat upon? What's something borrowed? And here we mean borrowed from other parts of Hollywood, right? Not necessarily borrowed from other Adam Sandler movies, but borrowed from a movie that Adam Sandler had nothing to do with. And then something blue, the definition of which is in constant debate over here at the ASCU studio.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, whether or not this movie is in the universe is to be decided at the end of the episode, but it is still a movie, right?
Yeah, it's still a movie.
So what are some things that we see in Sandler's filmmaking, right? So are you offering to go first, or shall I?
You know what? Why don't you go first on this one?
Okay, so for new, right?
So many,
we'll talk about this. I think that this might be kind of the first time, maybe the only time to be talked about, I guess, where we see Sandler in the real world, like the real world, right? So Sandler and the real girl. But there's something to this movie, and you mentioned the world building, the idea that it gives you a really good impression of exactly what people are up to at all moments. Hell, you mentioned even we watch a character go to the bathroom in this movie. You never see that, right?
Unless it's like, George Costanza and he's got to yell about selling latex, you're correct.
But there's this idea that so much effort is put into establishing this happens. This movie exists in your world, audience member, right? And like the closest one, funny enough, would probably have to be Hustle for me. And even then, Hustle goes out of its way to cast an actual NBA player and then do everything to create a fictional character of that, right?
I'm recording to talk about real world Sandler. I'd probably look at something like Funny People. I know that like very clearly Adam Sandler is meant to be playing someone other than himself.
Yes, definitely close. But I would point out that there is a level of silliness to that world that like things happen in that movie that if it happened in the real world, you'd be like, well, the police would be involved here, right?
Well, yes, there is that moment of it. But
Rain Over Me literally has that moment of the police would be involved and police show up,
yeah.
Right? Like that is so... To counter that exact idea, I get what you would be saying about something like Funny People.
I mean, they nail what it's like to be in the industry, what it's like to be on the stand-up circuit. So much of Funny People, one of the reasons why I didn't want to watch the movie is just it hit so close to home and what I was doing in my life at the time.
Well, and maybe that's what it is that was very, very, very real portrayal of what to normal people is a fantasy world. The world of stand-up comedy is, for all intents and purposes, a fucking Disney kingdom to most people, right? Like, it is not something that they deal with on a regular basis. They are not entering apartments that normal people live in that movie. They are not, you know what I mean? Like, they're not going into it to a world that everybody can instantly connect to. That movie has to lay a lot of groundwork to get you there. This movie simply just has to put a crying woman on screen in front of you and you instantly understand the feeling that is being displayed, right? Like, kind of to your point about kind of the simplicity to the choices that are made in this movie. Simple does not mean bad. I want to make sure that that's out there. But the idea that there is something on there, there is a language to this film that is so easy to understand, and by that nature makes it feel so tangible and so real that it is unlike any other Sandler movie in that regard.
Yeah. And it has to be, right? In order for you to connect on the level Mike Binder is hoping for you to connect on, this needs to be as real as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good point. I like that. I'm going to go with therapy. Clearly, Adam Sandler, prior to 2007, had done movies that dealt with therapy. There's a little movie called Anger Management I think we're going to have to cover eventually. What if what if Anger Management was just a movie where we're like, yeah, we're not doing that one?
No.
Good luck.
Oh God. Of all
good
the
luck.
Ones
figure
choose.
It out now. No, obviously, we're going to do it. If Adam Sandler's in it, we're going to cover
as much
the movie.
As that movie, that might be one of the cringiest films of my personal life. Like, but we'll talk about it when we talk about
we
that
talk
movie.
About it when we talk about
funny
it.
Enough, the other movie I think of when you say therapy is Click. Only because I feel like in a weird way that is Christopher Walken, and don't tell me the character's name because as far as I'm concerned it's just Christopher Walken, hands him a remote as therapy in that movie.
Well, he's the devil's agent. Spoilers
I
for Click.
That okay, not now.
Wait, well, not now especially. I can't wait. Yeah, Click. I'm suddenly excited to talk about Click. But when I think about this movie that is in the real world, right, and another one that's sort of in the real world, but kind of a hyper malleable molded version of the real world because it's a period piece is something like Uncut Gems. But the fact that there are for real consequences for all of his actions in that movie.
Maybe. We talked about when we talked about Uncut Gems how it's a parable more than anything.
Exactly.
There are people in that movie that are representative not of like a singular human that would act that way, but how most humans like a human
he's
in general
man.
Would.
I will agree with that. But one of the things that really sticks with me is that whole I'm so fucked up and I need help. In this movie, they're able to identify that somebody is fucked up, and then they get them the help that they need.
Yes.
Granted, it is real, real guilty of the only therapist we all know syndrome.
Yeah. Yes.
But, you know, you have to do a conservation of plot, conservation of characters. So it makes sense that Angela Oakhurst, portrayed by Liv Tyler, is the therapist that they all go to. In fact, This movie really wants to, like, keep secrets from you. They tease the 9/11 thing for so long.
Yeah.
And then once it's introduced, they throw it in your face every other scene.
It's funny that you mentioned Paul Thomas Anderson earlier, because now I'm really getting a lot of vibes also in the ensemble nature of this movie. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you do have that one character that you kind of everybody ends up going to for therapy. But of course, they have to in order to keep the ensemble being the ensemble. Right. Introducing yet another person takes away screen time from her, doesn't give enough screen time to anybody. Like, yeah. So there's definitely that sort of stuff going on.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's more and more about that P.T. Anderson shit than anything else.
Yeah, well, I mean, the more and more we look at it, but, you know, we're not at Borrowed yet, and I'm sure that's not what either of us has down for Borrowed, or maybe it is. So I'm going to be sharing my mom's new old Borrowed in Blue. She doesn't have a new. She doesn't know what that means. She hasn't been watching Adam Sandler stuff, but I do have an old and a Borrowed from her.
Oh, give me the old.
That are so good. And so we'll start with my mom's old. It's The Voice. She was so upset that he did that iconic Adam Sandler goofy voice in this movie. And it was one of those things for her where she's like, I was really into it. He was given this wonderful performance. And then he did that voice that I think of when I think of Adam Sandler. And it felt so out of place to me. And
I think that's interesting. We talked about The Voice before, and in it we talked about what makes The Voice work is how earnest it is, how true it is, like a real character to him, that character that he portrays. So I also noticed it, and also was, to your mom's point, kind of drawn out of the film because of it. But my immediate thought was, but this is him really leaning into the fact that he thinks that this is a, when he puts this voice on, he is not trying to make you laugh. He's trying to be real. And if in that reality, it also happens to make you laugh, that's what comedy is, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in this movie, that's just not where it's going. So I did also have that moment. So
yeah.
You
know what it is? It's not, he doesn't do the voice the whole time. There's like a specific moment. It's when he has his final confrontation with the Templemans. Which also he says so much by saying nothing in the start of that in the build up to it. But then as he's like getting that Adam passion that we see so often
and he's holding back, right?
Yeah,
like that's part of what it is it's the holding back anger that is very much where that voice comes from for him.
Yeah. And it's just, and she's like, I mean, his voice was solid, but there was that one moment and it took me out of it. And I just thought it was an interesting thing when you consider what the old of Adam Sandler is and the baggage that is brought into these films.
Do you think he improvised that kiss in that moment? Since we're talking about it.
It almost felt like he did. I really hope he did. Yeah, right? Because no matter what,
it's a beautiful moment.
It's a beautiful moment. And it's perfect. It's this perfect dichotomy of these people have been the villains sort of the whole movie. Their whole speech about we're the only family he has. And then the other thing about this movie is we see that he has Adele Modell, the landlady from hell, who clearly is looking out for him. He has Brian Sugarman, who, like, perhaps one of the most tragic characters of all, I was his best friend. We would do things together. And then September 12th, 2001, that ended. Yeah. But I can't cut the guy loose because he was my friend. But he doesn't want anything to do with me as his friend because I'm too much of a reminder of what he lost. And it's just like, oh, God, this poor bastard. But clearly he cares about him, too. Like,
but the way we're introduced to him, to the original point, right, is we find out about him first from the mother-in-law who calls him a shyster and says that he's just trying to get his money.
Yeah.
And, like, so when we first meet him, there is a weird moment where we're just like, well, we were warned about you. But then
the words he's saying is, you're not going to take advantage of him. He's not giving you $1 million. And it's just like, what is happening?
Yeah,
it is something. But that kiss, right? And we've talked about Adam Sandler clearly being this person who acts in the moment. Mm-hmm. It really is this beautiful thing of like, goodbye. This is a goodbye kiss. Like I said my piece, and I can't deal with you people anymore because this is how you treat me. Goodbye, kiss on the cheek.
But also it's a recognition on his part of the work that everything that they've done being motivated by caring about him.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to ignore that. He makes his point about why he needs to be the way that he is, what he's doing, why he's making the choice he's making. He makes it very clearly. He puts his foot down and takes charge of his own future in that moment. And it's gorgeous. But that admission of this is truly over for me. I am not holding both in a sense that, like, I don't think I can see you anymore, but I am also no longer going to hold a grudge because that would be the same as seeing you still, right? Like I'm not gonna hold on to this. So it is this beautiful goodbye kiss in all of the different layers of meaning that it has. And I couldn't tell you for the life of me, the way that he performs in that moment is so natural that it almost feels like it is just what Charlie does.
Yeah.
It's wild, that moment where that is really hits home for me.
Being the cynical asshole in this moment, because I feel like there has to be one, it's also kind of Charlie save the cat moment. In this moment where, like, we've seen him do some real despicable things, but, like, the fact that he can still acknowledge what they've done for him, even as they've done some despicable things.
I don't know if I call it save the cat, but it's definitely growth.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it definitely shows you that Charlie has changed by the end of this movie. In some way. You're not sure how, but he has.
I guess the reason why I look at it that way is they are so despicable leading up to that one moment. When what BJ Novak is doing, when they're baiting him for a reaction in the courtroom, and Donald Sutherland, again, as a judge who gets everything and understands what's going on in the world, the only person with a brain is a judge in an Adam Sandler movie, and he puts a stop to it. There's that shot of Ginger where she is so happy to see her little plan playing out. And it is the moment where I'm like, I don't give a shit about you anymore. It is the moment where she drowns the puppy. So for him, for this character who has had these violent outbursts, who we have seen at his worst so many times in this movie, to kiss her and acknowledge everything that she has done for him, despite it being for the selfish reasons of wanting somebody to blame for the loss of her daughter, it really is that moment where I'm like, yeah, I can root for Charlie. I can definitely root for Charlie till the end of the film. and to the end of days. Like,
yeah, it's interesting because, like, as I mentioned, like, I see him kind of as like this, like, almost God, not like God with a capital G, but godlike, like, figure in this story about grief, where he comes in and he is literally the god of grief in this film. No one can hold more grief than him at any point in this movie, right?
This is where I want to bring up Will Smith and Collateral Beauty, and also say Jada Pinkett Smith. But from now on, I'll keep her name out my mouth.
Don't do that. We are better than that.
We're not better than that. It's what you're talking about, this god of grief. That's exactly what Will Smith plays in Collateral Beauty.
Yeah, so that's not what you just said that I'm calling you out on. What are you doing right
now?
Well,
no, and then I'm connecting the dots that are on my paper. I thought it was going to be a clown, but it was a terrible reference to this year's Oscars.
It's still a clown. So this moment, right, is you watch. So his growth is almost unexpected, and I'm not gonna say unnecessary or unneeded, but like so unexpected that when it happens, it hits, and you realize that it's earned because it's not much. It is literally just this moment.
Oh, this film earns everything. I'll go on record for that.
Well, I mean, and that's what it gets for playing it safe, right? Yeah. Is it earns those moments when they do happen. But then on top of that, like, it makes you realize that you finally got what you wanted. Like, it's a catharsis you didn't realize you needed. And that is choice. Like, it's a great moment. Sorry, you mentioned this speech, and it was dumb for me to not bring up this key moment of the movie for me.
No, it's wonderful. I mean, that's what New Old Bar of Blue is. It helps us refocus.
That's why it ends up being
film.
Half the episode.
Yeah, that's why it's the favorite part of the show is for that. So what's your old? And then I'll share mine.
So it's old to us, but actually not old to Sandler, because we had one of those moments where we kind of flip-flopped, right? But this is the only other Madison 23 film in the Sandler like pantheon is the only word that comes to mind. So he creates Madison 23 for this, and not just we talk about Happy Madison Productions a lot, and I don't know if we've ever really gushed about the fact that it's actually technically run by Scott Sandler, his brother. So they create Madison 23 as kind of this offshoot of Happy Madison Productions with the intention of them handling the heavier shit, right? Like almost like, what is it, TriStar to Disney? Is that who they
Touchstone is to Disney. TriStar is to Sony.
It's
for more experimental stuff. Sorry.
Right. That's the idea though, right? Yeah. If you want to do something that's kind of out of your realm, but you still want to have your stamp on it, then you create a little subsidiary of your production company, right?
And then once it sells big in Hot Topic, you put it under the banner of Walt Disney, and everybody doesn't know that Night Before Christmas was a Touchstone fixture to begin
Patrick
with.
Patrick Stewart knows. we're not talking about that right now.
but you brought it up.
Yeah, but this idea being that like Madison 23 is created for this, it's only used one other time, and that's for Funny People, another movie that we have already talked about, and then we never see it again because it kind of becomes pretty obvious that they don't really need to do that. I don't know if it's because they realize they're not going to do much dramatic work in the future or what, but they pull away from that. The only other time in their career, in the history of their production company that this happens is, I think it's for Hubie Halloween, they slap the name Scary Madison.
Oh no, Scary Madison is for maybe Dead Silence. It's for a horror movie that Adam Sandler does not show up in. Hubie Halloween is very much a Happy Madison picture. Madison.
I couldn't tell you where it came from. All I know is that that's all anybody could talk about is, besides Madison 23, the only other time they did it was Scary Madison, and nobody can tell if it was a joke or not, just because it was a scary movie. Did they just put Scary Madison just to be funny, or is it actually another production company technically? And this matters to like no one really, but like accountants.
All accounts, they were hoping to branch out, because it is not their type of scary movie. It's not a scary movie like Scary Movie. It's legitimately trying to be like Blumhouse. So it's trying to compete with, around this time, things like The Descent or Saw. It is very much, we want people to know that we're involved with this, but we want people to know that they should be afraid of this movie.
Yeah. I think it's The Shortcut.
It is The Shortcut. Thank you. Sorry, you just said Dead Silence, and wouldn't that have just been a wonderful bit of like coincidence? It is The Shortcut.
So it starts off as a short that they then make into a full movie, and it is The Shortcut, a Happy Madison production. It actually gets the Happy Madison title eventually. Apparently, in its history, they removed the Scary Madison title card, or what? I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that's why nobody can tell if it was a real or not.
Yeah. it does feel like, based on some of the stuff I read while I was going through Madison 23, because honestly, there was part of me that thought it might be a happy little accident, especially since it had like a full-on title card, and it does not have a full-on title card for Funny People. For Funny People, it is just an Apatow slash Madison 23 production over the opening. So I'm like, oh, okay, so they're clearly the same thing, and then I found a bunch of documentation that supported it, and also talked about the only other time they did this was Scary Madison, and The Shortcut didn't do well. I mean, imagine if Adam Sandler had been in the actual, like, horror spinoff movie.
Imagine if he played, like, that killer or something. Yeah. That would have been great.
Or imagine if one of the other people that we know so much from the Pantheon, like John Loughran as a sort of a Leatherface character, would be incredible. But yeah, the Madison
Vanilla 20... Ice is the cameo kill, right? Like
in the opening. I mean, it could have been something.
Could
really
be the
cool.
opening. See, remember, Scream did that because you thought, oh, it's Drew Barrymore, she'll live, and then she doesn't, which is why it pulls it on you. I think Ice-T would have. I think Vanilla Ice would have fallen more into that category of the no, you're not killing me in 10 minutes. I'm making it to the end, and I die heroically. Thank you.
I'm gonna be the Matthew Lillard of this bitch, but I was only pretending to be a killer. Satire, boom. It all.
We don't talk about Vanilla Ice enough.
He's so good in the two movies he's been in so far. But yeah, so Madison 23 is a very interesting thing. But also, I get why. And really, when you look at everything wrapped up in it, Rain Over Me kind of crashes and burns because I'm a fucking asshole. Those are the words I said. I could edit this out, but I'm not going to. And then Funny People doesn't do as well as they hoped it would. So let's just shutter it up and then look at all the movies they did that were pretty much just Adam Sandler comedies. With Hotel Transylvania as the family fair until something like Uncut Gems. So that when Uncut Gems does hit the world, everybody is like, who knew Adam Sandler could act?
You're right.
It's very much a cocoon that they put acting Adam in. Oh, I can't believe I said what I said.
And then he comes out of it Chrysalith. So that was my old. But you have another old then, yeah?
Yeah, my other old is Adam Sandler's real-life assistant on this film was John Loughran. And that was one of those situations where I always watch the credits, and I saw that, and I'm like, I'm really, really happy that someone from the Adam Sandler pantheon worked on this film in some way, shape, or form. It made me smile to see John Loughran's name.
Well, so that's another thing to kind of point out. And maybe we're too little late in the game for this. I maybe should have brought this up earlier. But one of the reasons that this feels like it's got a lot of these weird moves for Sandler is we have never... Like, I think I've said before, it feels like this was a very hands-off thing for Sandler. I think just go with it, right? I talked a lot about how it felt like there was a lot of Sandler moments, but then there were moments where it felt like Sandler had nothing to do with them. This movie is so not their baby. Even though Madison 23 is on it, like this is a Mike Binder film through and through, right? So, like, there's not these weird moments where it feels like Sandler got a hold of the script and changed something. There's not these weird moments where a character shows up just so that one of his friends can be there. And so the consequence, the symptoms, the turnout of that is that you don't see that kind of stuff happening, and so you do really have to go digging to find any type of Sandler-esque connection in that regard.
Yeah, it's something else. It honestly is something else, and I think I get it in a lot of ways, because we look at what Adam did with The Softies and Uncut Gems, and being mostly hands-off with everything but the character he was playing. Look at what it was able to accomplish. I think if Adam is playing a role like that he did not write, that's where he wants to focus his energies. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting when you consider something like Shadow of the Colossus being such a big plot point in this movie. It's like, and you think of that like, oh, that's got to be because Sony, it's a Columbia picture, or Adam Sandler just loves video games. And then it turns out that like, it's just somebody working on the film who's like, I know you wanted to be some 80s game to really drill home the whole, arrested development that he's retreated into. But there's this game that's kind of a perfect metaphor for fighting against fallen giants.
Yeah.
And trying to bring back the person you've lost.
Well, and for anybody that doesn't know too much about Shadow of the Colossus, I'm sorry for spoilers for anybody that's that interested, but like finding out by the end of that game that you really have kind of been the villain the whole time of your own story, like, right? And like what you've been doing is actually world destroying, is a huge part of the metaphor of that game, like brought into this movie because of the fact that you don't just see it once and it's not just name dropped. It shows up multiple times, becomes kind of plot significant to the point where the end of this movie, like the big cathartic like breath of air at the end of this movie is Charlie in a new apartment with Alan playing the game.
Yeah
it's wild.
I want to know what that controller he's using is.
Yes, I know.
It kind of looks like the Logitech wireless that like everybody loved for the PS2, but it's more GameCube like. I don't know, that's not what the show's about, but if you know, get in contact with us at the ASCU on Twitter. I'd like to know the controller. I would also like to know the messenger bag that Charlie uses the entire film, because it's beautiful. It is such a beautiful... I need a good messenger bag, and Charlie has the best messenger bag.
Yeah.
That's me being a jerk, kind of. I'd like to finish on my mom's borrowed, because it blew me away. It was ASCU worthy, so I'd like to finish on it. So do you want to go first here, or do you want me to take it?
Yeah, no, I'll go first, because we've already kind of mentioned a lot of what we talked about. So, I mean, first of all, Bob Dylan's haircut. The big thing is the I'm trying to think of the proper term for this, because I don't think it exists. If it does, I would love for somebody to send me the information on it. But it is not just the buddy comedy, but the, like, othered buddy comedy. There has to be one of or both of the two buddies need to be kind of dealing with some type of otherness. And in this movie, it is Charlie's mental state. I don't know if it's classifiable or not as a mental illness, but like his mental state is definitely something that separates him from the rest of the world, right? Other examples of this being movies like The Soloist and Rain Man, movies we already talked about, right? Like this movie clearly borrows from that tradition of like getting two guys on screen, give one of them an issue to deal with of some type, and like let the sparks fly, let the Oscars just flow in, that kind of shit, right? And so again, like pointing back to Tom Cruise kind of walking away from this movie, he like that has to be what's going on here, right? Because this feels, so many of these moments feel like they are just straight out of like the off-all of Rain Man. Like it is almost unfortunate if you're not too caught up in the 9/11 of it all.
Yeah. To go along with the Rain Man of it all, almost all of the character choices that Adam Sandler puts into Charlie Fineman is Dustin Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
His voice is so Ratso Rizzo. And a lot of the mannerisms that he plays are very similar to what he was doing with Rain Man. And it's not completely off base when you consider something like Hot Water Burn Baby off of Stan and Judy's Kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's a character that Adam Sandler had played with before, was doing Raymond from Rain Man. So right. It's not completely off base. But then to also sprinkle on the whole Ratso Rizzo of it all, and then kind of... in a way, borrow from Midnight Cowboy and the codependent relationship that you have in that movie is really interesting for something like this film.
Yeah.
But then, just because we're talking about the othered buddy comedy, what I wrote down first, and maybe it's because I'm just a huge fan of this movie, is The Wizard.
Yes.
The Fred Savage, Lucas Black. But it's closer in line to something like The Wizard, because Fred Savage's character in The Wizard is a really good analog for Don Cheadle's Alan, because they see the Charlie or his brother in that movie, Jimmy, as a way to escape the mundanity in their lives.
Yeah,
by
I mean,
dedicating myself to that, it's not so much like Rain Man. He really kind of sees this opportunity to like take advantage of his brother. Like
right.
That's what he's doing. But it's more the fact in something like The Wizard that what Fred Savage's character, I wish I could remember his character's name right now. I feel kind of bad about that. Is like, if I go with Jimmy, I can use Jimmy as the excuse for why I'm acting so crazy. So like at the end of the day, Jimmy can kind of take the fall for my actions, which is real heavy what Alan is sort of doing. Like, there's that great speech from Jada Pinkett Smith of, I think you're envious of him. You covet his freedom. And, like, that's a weird way of looking at it, but it's sort of the exact thing in The Wizard. And then also when you consider the fact that, like, Jimmy is building these great monuments and then he finds video games as a way to center himself, right into the fact that, like, Shadow of the Colossus is so much of what Charlie is using to work through his grief. And the fact that he's only gotten through 12 of the 20 Colossi, like, I think the end of that game will break him.
Yeah. I didn't really want to focus too much on like what it would mean for him to end it. It's just interesting that he is, I guess.
Yeah, no, but it
but
is.
But it's Corey, by the way, from Friends.
Corey, thank you. Yeah. Well, and you know what's hard about that is that his brother played Corey in Boy Meets World.
So you think you're just making it up. Yeah.
All right, so here's from my mom. What I need you to do is I need you to give me the name of Ginger Templeman's actress, because I've been mispronouncing it all day.
The older woman. Yeah. Her name is Melinda Dillon.
So Melinda Dillon is my mother's borrowed. Can you name another movie that Melinda Dillon is in?
I mean, if I don't click on her picture here, no.
Okay.
Not off the top of my head.
All right, so that's good. I couldn't either. But Melinda Dillon is the mother in A Christmas Story. So the fact that this movie ends with her getting a lamp as a consolation prize, my mother would not shut up about it, about the Christmas Story reference there. And then in my mind, I'm thinking about the fact that the father in A Christmas Story plays Billy Madison's dad.
Yeah.
So like,
Darren McGavin, yeah.
It is one of those situations where like, Adam got to work with both of the parents of A Christmas Story. And if that movie wasn't somehow like important to him growing up, I would not believe that.
Yeah, no. Like, right? I mean, it's kind of the gold standard for lighthearted family like fare that just sells a dime. Like, they could literally play it 1,000 times at Christmas and people will sit and watch it multiple times. It's what Adam Sandler has aimed for his entire career.
Exactly. And it was just such a great thing. Like, the whole lamp thing seems like kind of out of nowhere at the last minute. As her mother to be like,
I thought I missed some part of the movie where she like mentioned a lamp or something like that.
It comes up in the courtroom and maybe there's deleted scenes or something there, but it is one of those situations. And my mother's like, that was Christmas story. And I'm like, I'm gonna put that in the podcast, Mom, because you blew me away. With the weirdly borrowed thing there. Especially because she hates the lamp and she ends up smashing it, you know, allegedly, in A Christmas Story, but it being such a meaningful piece to her in this movie.
Yeah. You know, there's other stuff going on, too. You mentioned, just because we mentioned so much of how he builds the character of Charlie in this, and there's a lot of... Not The Who. The Who is a lot in this movie, but it's not The Who. It's Syd Barrett, whatever band he was a part of, famously went through a lot of this stuff, like kind of
Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd.
He was the first
singer
of Pink Floyd.
Yeah. Now you say it, like it hits like a brick.
Yeah,
get it.
In the Wall.
Yeah, there you
animals,
go.
Pigs,
jokes, much
time.
Man, I was also thinking of Brian Wilson, but I think Syd Barrett's the one that's even like name dropped, I think, in like the IMDb trivia or something like that. Like, there's just who famously, sorry, I don't think I finished this thought, kind of went into seclusion because of some issues with mental illness to the point where he like pushed a lot of people away. So like, there's also a lot of that going on too, right? So he's borrowing from a lot of places to build the character. So that alone is like a plethora of this. But in terms of the larger film, there's definitely a lot going on here that is more, and maybe this kind of goes back to a lot of what you were talking about with Bender kind of doing some filmmaking 101. I mean, like, Rain Man is filmmaking 101 for a lot
for
of people,
this type right? of movie,
right?
Like, it is pretty much as basic as you can get, and it's interesting. I'm gonna go back to old real quick too, because I have it written here and I didn't mention it, but I think it's worth mentioning. I got real Spanglish energy from the whole problems going on in Alan's life.
A lot of a lot of references to Spanglish. This is kind of being thrown up there. Weirdly, we gave that movie a lot of flack when we watched it, and you know, we mentioned that at the time. A lot of people did. A lot of the research that I was doing on Rain Over Me kind of showed me that there has been a somewhat of a cultural turn on Spanglish in terms of really kind of falling back in love with that movie, because a lot of people in kind of talking about, like, you know, Adam Sandler, like, the guy is just out there making movies to be with his friends, and sometimes he puts in the hard work, realizes it's not worth it, and goes home. And so many people being like, yeah, you know, I love Rain Over Me, but I can understand why he doesn't make more movies like that, considering how, you know, how it's kind of remembered and then how it did. And then, like, people being like, I don't know, you talk about Rain Over Me, you got to talk about Punch Drunk Love. And then eventually somebody always says, you know, you got to talk about Spanglish, like, in all of those conversations. And it's like, man, okay, all right, Spanglish getting more due than I thought, than I remembered or would have thought when we watched it. But you're not the only person I heard kind of bring up that memory of Spanglish with this movie. Yeah.
Especially when you come down to the fact that, like, we didn't touch on Donna Remack as a character at all in this film yet, but the whole fact that she represents this temptation to spice up his life with an affair, and he is constantly shutting it down. Like, I'm so proud of Alan every time. She's like, yeah, a 40s actress.
Well, since you've already done talked about it, I'll just roll into it, because yeah, it sounds like we're moved on to Blue.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my Blue definitely has to, and there's no doubt about it, be the stalker patient story, right? And to your point, we never see him taking advantage of it, but the point is that it is something that is there for him to use if he so chooses. So, like, the power is completely in his hands. No matter how much he's using that power, as much as he's choosing not to use it, this movie does not shy away from giving that power to Alan constantly in those situations, and it just feels gross. And, like, it, you know, it's supposed to, so, like, take that for what you want, but, like, it was just the one part of this movie that every time it happened, it felt unnecessarily uncomfortable. There's tons of uncomfortable moments in this movie, but as you said earlier, everything kind of feels like it has a point, right? Like, it feels like everything is earned in this movie. This is the one thing that I think gets close to not doing it for me, is just the power dynamic between the two of them, this patient of his that's clearly taking things too far in so many ways. I mean, she ends up accusing him of sexual harassment.
One of my borrowed was almost white oleander.
Yeah.
Like that I'm just like, oh my god, like the white oleander of it all. And then also you look at it through the 2022 lens and everything we saw with the Me Too and the fact that, like, this is a movie where the actual story is her lying about him having sexually assaulted her, which is something that, like, I mean, maybe it's just from Seinfeld, but it feels like a thing that dentists have been dealing with.
Dentists were in a weird position in the 2000s, because I was also really, I couldn't help but think about how this movie really paints, like, dentistry in, like, such a weird dark light. And then I thought, didn't Whole Nine Yards do that too? Isn't that the movie that kind of starts the whole, like, repeating the straight up lie that dentistry is, like, the number one suicide like career in the United States? And it's just like, why were dentists
getting and they're in Canada too, so that's even weirder.
Oh man,
yeah, it is. It's a really weird thing. And then there's that throwaway line that something like this has happened before. And then, like, in my mind, I'm like, oh my god, was there a time where Alan cheated with a patient?
And they never go back to it,
they
right?
They never go back to it. The receptionist is all, oh, someone else who's got a crush on you. And, like, they kind of play it as humor. But then when they're talking about the letter that they received, and they're like, this is just like last time. And I'm like, oh my god, did something else happen? Is Alan got, like, some dark secret that we're going to unearth? And it's like, no, we don't have time for that. This is going to be about Charlie Feinman.
Yeah, so we have this character played by Donna Remar. Saffron Burrows is the character's name.
Nope, Saffron Burrows is the actor. Donna Remar is the character.
Oh, yeah, that backwards. Thank you.
She goes on to be an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
But we've got this really, you know, we've got a lot going on here in this story, in the ways in which she's throwing herself at Alan, and then when she's not reciprocated, she retaliates with this thing. But it does lead to one of my favorite moments in the movie, and that's after spending enough time with Charlie, Alan kind of working up the guts, because he's been told that he was the guy that didn't take any shit in college, to go in and scream at what's his nuts from Breaking Bad,
Jonathan Banks.
Jonathan Banks.
Statler
Is
is
that
his character's
Statler?
name.
Yes. Yeah.
Jonathan Banks is the actor. I love Jonathan
And like he
Banks.
goes and just like lays the fucking law down. And the only thing about that moment that really kind of felt weird for me is I kept getting the impression that Alan was more important at this place than it seemed, but he's never placed, like physically, never placed in a power position in any scene with those dudes. And maybe that's purposeful, right? Because in that moment, he's like, I created this practice and I could kick your asses out. And I'm just like, oh, you did? Because that's not what it's felt like this whole time.
Well, that's there's a moment. It's the first time him and Charlie are hanging out, when he comes to his door and he's like, "It's 10:30, you're in bed. Come on, let's go hang out." And don't ask her for permission. Like that whole thing. That whole sequence. And he's like, she wants to blow me. And
Oh,
what really
that great old joke where he's like, you don't have to ask her permission for me to go out. Like, I'm my own man. And then
And then
he's
he
like,
asks
okay,
her
do you want
for
to go out? And
permission.
then he looks to his wife for permission. It's like, okay,
Yeah,
ha, that's
the Honeymooners was a thing in the 50s.
it.
The Flintstones was just the Honeymooners, but animated. And Fred Flintstone used to smoke a bunch of cigarettes.
Blowing my mind.
but it's that sequence when they're first hanging out, and he's commiserating with Charlie about what's going on with Donna, and he talks about the fact that, the liability will go up, and if he loses his partners, he's stuck with a 5-year lease. $30,000 a month, and like he'd be fucked. He would be unable to pay the lease on that office space
Right.
without the other work that they're bringing in. I mean, that's $3 million, Sijin, for their office space, for a 5-year lease. That's crazy. That's insane amounts of money. And the really weird thing is that like his name does come first. It's JS&H, so it's Johnson, Stettler, and I think it's Homs is the third guy. I don't know. He never talks. He's just always there in the office. But I think it's one of those situations where, like, they're older, so they feel like they're just capital to keep the place going, and he's the one who's doing all the work.
They are constantly always just sitting in that office talking, where it always seems like Johnson Allen is out there fucking with all the patients, not fucking with all the patients, but he's
Well,
spending all the
maybe
time
we
with.
don't know, but
Well, and so like then my brain starts kind of like going through like the motions of, well, did he lose like power here because of what happened last time? Quotes around the mysterious story of what happened last time. Did he maybe lose the practice to them in some way?
the fact
But
that
no,
their insurance
he's
is already through the roof too, like we can't afford to have to pay more insurance, and he never complains about that. Like, and I was a little upset that, like, once we learned about the money, that $1 million payoff was to, like, as apology because you're my only friend, I can't lose you, and not sort of like, no, man, like, get out from under them so you can be your own man. Because I think that'd be a more powerful moment. This idea of like Charlie thinking that's the only way that he can be a friend to him, and him being like, no, I don't need your money, I just need you to listen to me. Like,
I mean, it's the same
yeah.
effect in the end, and I think it's more topical is not the right word, surface level. It's more surface level, making it about, oh, the way I behaved last night, I'm sorry, here's a bunch of money. And this
Yeah.
movie is nothing if not surface level
Yeah,
shit,
it's
right?
very true. And then I'm remembering my time with Black or White, and it was weirdly surface level as well. As much as I wanted to enjoy it, it was. I'm glad I saw the Lazarus Project or the afterwards. And then I drove to New Haven and saw What We Do in the Shadows. 2014 was a weird year. But yeah, so sorry to bring it all back together. Yeah, like that whole sequence is really strange. And then there's this one moment that I kind of hate, where Donna says that she's acting on her feelings for Alan because her therapist told her to. Now, already, because of conservation of plot, when she says in the beginning, "I see another doctor in the building," and then we meet Angela, I'm like, oh, well, that's the other doctor in the building. Right? So then when she says that whole thing about my therapist advised me to do it, it's one of those situations where, and again, this is very surface level, so what I'm saying is all moot anyway, but I still kind of want to get it off my chest because it would have been a more interesting interaction between these characters. And unfortunately, the women are very poorly developed in this movie. You talk about the stalker patient story, but also the fact that like Jada Pinkett Smith just flat out disappears from the final
Oh,
two-thirds of this
for
film.
Angela, Angela's another character that I honestly thought was all in fucking Alan's head because he only ever runs into her in the street for the first like half of this
Yeah,
movie. It's always the same bridge that they're walking over when they talk to each other.
Yeah, it's like it's just this weird thing. And Angela has one really subtle bit of character development after Charlie tells her that all he can think about is her breasts while they're in the thing, and then the next session she's wearing that big bulky sweater, and it's just like, oh, okay, that was subtle, Bender. I don't think the people in the back got it. The people watching TMNT got what you were doing there. All right, guy. sorry. With that deep green plunge, that V plunge. In TMNT, sorry, but yeah, like, that whole thing, it would be more interesting if, like, you don't know how she's presenting her attraction to Alan to her therapist, and it's not crazy for a therapist to say, "Well, if you think that there's this connection between you, why don't you try acting on it?"
Especially if it's Angela, because as we learn through the rest of the movie, Angela is not well versed at reading people yet in her
Right. Which
career.
is
I mean,
another
what
weird
happens
thing.
with Charlie is like a doctor straight up calls her out on it and is
Yeah.
just like, "No, I'm not going to give this patient back to you. While he was in your care, he attempted literal suicide by cop. Like, why would I release him to you?" It's
Yeah.
like, yeah, he's got a point
Yeah, where's
there.
an inter you know, when you say it like that, those words in that order with that tone, you might have a point.
Yeah, well, and so what we were kind of saying about the beginning of this movie about how this movie has real world consequences for that sort of shit.
Yeah.
Like actually hearing somebody say, "No, I'm not going to give this person back to you," was very much like, yeah, obviously.
But it's one of those weird things where, like, I could totally believe Angela telling her, "Well, if you think this guy might be attracted to you and you have these feelings, why not try acting on them?" But then the fact that she's just like, "I lied about my therapist saying that," it's like, no, you had a more interesting storyline there. Like, this connection between all of these people. And then you have Angela having to apologize for saying that. Like, she didn't tell me it was you. It's just because it's all surface level, but then it is, you know, we're talking about the blue here. We're talking about the Sijin definition of blue, and now I feel ashamed of what mine's going to be. But it's very strange how the women are constantly cut off from any sort of character development in this movie. Like, even Ginger, like, she has that one moment of like severe like glee being taken in what BJ Novak is doing to Charlie, but Robert Klein takes the lead in every scene after that first one where she approaches Alan.
Yes.
And it's sad. It really is like sad. Which brings me to my blue, so
Ooh,
that maybe we
yeah.
can move forward. It's the tambourine in the I Love You Man scene. It's a
Nice.
sparkle glitter tambourine, and it made me oh so happy.
It's like a phenomenal scene, though.
That scene is fantastic.
The two of them building their friendship or rebuilding their friendship is beautiful to watch.
Yeah. It's a good movie. It's a good movie, and then it just has some really heavy shit going on within it.
Yeah, well, I mean, what, anything else that we kind of left on the floor here? I mean, like, we have to talk about the soundtrack of this movie,
We
right? First
do
of
have
all,
to
it's
talk about
named after a Who song, "Rain Over
it's
Me," right?
kind of named after a Who song. It's named after Love, Rain, or Me. So, like, you cut the love off, and we take out that apostrophe to make it over again, and then we call it Rain Over Me.
I mean,
It's
that just
sort of
feels
a
like.
bait and switch from the director.
Kind of in the same way that they bait and switch you into listening to a couple of moments from The Who singing that song midway through the film, but then you are treated to a full rendition of Pearl Jam's version of it at the end of
My
the movie.
old was almost a terrible cover of an iconic song over the credits. Because freaking The Wedding Singer is oh so 80s, and then it's like, and here's the presidents of the United States singing Video Killed the Radio Star. Bye, y'all. And this is like, no, what are you doing? What, why?
This
Yeah.
last impression of this film as you walk out of the theater, hold on to this one forever, folks. Yeah, no, I will say that I think that the choice to change it probably wanted it to be. I bet you at some point it had the whole shebang of it being "Love, Rain Over Me," and somebody was just like, "I don't know, not enough people are gonna like that. That reference is not gonna hit enough." But "Rain Over Me" sounds like it definitely could keep going. And then, you know, people who get it, and it becomes like an in joke, right? Like, this is marketing guy like talking here. Like, we're going to hide the reference while still letting you have it, right? It works for me, but also because the whole soundtrack does, right? Like, the soundtrack of this movie, minus the Pearl Jam, I think I've discussed my feelings about Pearl Jam on the main show before. They're not stellar. Minus that moment of over the credits, every time a song comes up in the movie, it's phenomenal. And like, part of that is because of how well it's built into the movie, right? Like, it's not like every time a radio comes on, a great song plays, but like this idea being that there's always kind of a reference to the fact that this is the kind of music that Charlie is listening to or would be listening to in this moment. It's really cool in that way.
Marketing guy here, and really the guy who wrote the script, so I guess I'm playing Michael Binder in this moment. I deliver this script to you, and it is titled Stuck in Charlie Land. Or just Charlie Land. We can lose the stuck in.
Charlie Land.
Because there's that line from Jada Pinkett Smith where she's just like, oh, yeah, well, what were you, stuck in Charlie Land? And I'm like, I wanted to applaud. Right? Like, that was the moment where I wanted to
Charlie
applaud.
Land, here it is. It's Charlie Land, and then you have real life Don Cheadle and Adam Sandler sitting on a drawn park bench with a drawn New York skyline behind them that has a faint whiff of the Twin Towers behind the title so that anybody that's looking for it sees it, but otherwise you don't.
The L and the top of the H in Charlie. Or no, the L in Charlie and the L in Land represent the Twin Towers.
Oh, man. But behind them, and they are real.
Behind them,
And it's all a drawn with, like, animated birds and shit. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's the indie version of this
2007,
movie. 2007, folks. If Madison 23 doesn't come in to say, how about we make this a real movie? Yeah, it just, like, that was that moment where I'm just like, I feel like that's the working title of this movie. Yeah. And what an interesting thing, because there's so much. This is a movie. First of all, it's from 2007, and on our other show right now, what Sijin and I are exploring are those films that we saw together in 2007, and we're going on a real nostalgia trip doing that. So then to watch this movie, which is all about the nostalgia of college on Don Cheadle's part,
Really
interesting.
Yeah, nostalgia's been a beast for a long time, man.
Yeah, and then I also, like, I brought up High Fidelity, but then what I think of, right, like, in the evolutionary chart of this style of movie, you start with High Fidelity, and then the missing link is something like Love Monkey. I don't know, the book specifically, not the failed MTV show that starred Ed and introduced the world to Teddy Geiger, who has now transitioned, and I'm not sure of what their name is, so I apologize for that. But that's who they played in the show was that character.
That's worth doing some research on. Let's give somebody their proper name.
Yeah. So it's like Love Monkey, the book specifically, is one of the first books that I remember reading, and it's so backed up. It feels very much like a sequel to High Fidelity. I feel that's what the author was going for. But then it's a book that was released post 9/11, and it
Jeff, you get a free pass on this one. Their chosen name, their real name for now, is Teddy Geiger.
Oh, good. Excellent. I mean, I know that they had transitioned, and I supported it. Their debut album was fantastic, and I bought it only because of the show Love Monkey, and then I just fell in love with it. So I followed it, but I'm like, I don't know if they ended up changing their name. Thank you. Yeah. Teddy Geiger, check them out. Yep. It's fantastic.
Teddy has said that they intend to use female pronouns, and she was going to keep the name Teddy Geiger. So there you go.
Fantastic. But the book specifically of Love Monkey, like around chapter 18, opens with 9/11 happening as he's on his way to his job. And it's one of those first times that I remember media being touched by the events of 9/11, at least media that I had come to. And then it's really crazy when you think that, like, MTV is going to make a TV show of this, and we're going to heavily avoid that topic matter that, like, made this book an important read. So then you get to something like Rain Over Me, which feels so influenced by that, like, looking back at the nostalgia of when you're young. I mean, really, you take the Rob character from High Fidelity, you split him down the middle, all the music is with Charlie, and all the hopes and dreams of what could have been, what might have been back when I was in college, is dropped on Don Cheadle. And it just feels like such an interesting, like, progression of that style of story.
Yeah. It also, like, the movie very heavily captures kind of an older generation's kind of experience with 9/11, kind of, and I think of this specifically when I think about the music. And part of that is because I'm coming hot off the heels of seeing a really phenomenal documentary this year at Sundance that was about kind of the music that was born out of September 11th, Meet Me in the Bathroom. And there's a book by the same name that the documentary is just a filmed version of the events kind of categorized there, cataloged there, categorized. But anyway, that coming off of that and kind of seeing the ways in which music that I grew up with and consider like influential to that time for me, and like coming out of everything that happened after 9/11 and listening to that, and then like watching this movie where none of that is present. That is just not the world that's here for a dude that is so into music. But we are very much told that Charlie definitely has his choices, right? Like
And
he
unlike
once
the
he
OJs or Earth, Wind, and Fire,
Right.
the other side of funk, oh, such a good album.
Yeah, but he just like when he makes a decision about a thing, he clearly sticks to it. Add to that he is very purposely trying to avoid not thinking about those events, right? So he latches onto things that are so far removed from it, like music that is this old. It's a really interesting way to explore kind of this older generation's view of these events at this time, because seeing the kind of stuff that they chose to latch onto, because we didn't have the choice of looking back on these older times in our lives before those events, right? Those were the older times in our lives that were these events. These were our formative years, whereas for some people, for half of this world, they were the end of their lives. So yeah, it's just really weird for me to kind of get that kind of view into a generational look at these kinds of events.
Which is really interesting that you bring up Meet Me in the Bathroom, because one of the questions that I had is when they go to the Webster, my question is Charlie like a house drummer for them, or is he in that band that is so indicative of all of those like groups that were formed in the wake of 9/11? And he
Yeah,
just drums with them.
it's a weird conversation, right? Because on the one hand, like, it is clearly the closest he gets to kind of feeling anything about it is when he's up on stage drumming. So him being with people that are kind of going through that same process, like, totally makes sense, works within the movie. But if you told me that he was not their usual drummer and just drummed for anybody that was like getting on stage that night that needed one, I'd believe it. And that kind of shit happened all the time, right? People would trade off bassists like they were fucking like gum in a playing card
Bassists were
deck.
weirdly
Like,
gold and baseball gum.
but yeah, that idea of being that like
Because it's clearly not
that
his
he
drum set. It's clearly a house
yeah
drum set. And
yeah
the fact that it's punk's open mic night, it's one of those. And then they're upset that you're late. And it's like, is the Webster upset that their like in-house drummer is late? But, like, because I don't. It was the thing that really left me with the most questions of this movie.
I mean, the music scene in New York has always been weird.
Yeah.
Point blank,
Yes.
like just point blank, that is just the music scene in New York has always been crazy. It has always been energetic, kinetic, like people moving between groups all the time. It's why you never have like a group, but it's always an artist that gets kind of focused on from the New York scene, because they can form six different groups in a matter of months. And like that's just how that kind of all works and happens, especially during this time when kids were just like trying to just fucking just get into the damn city, right? Like they were just they just wanted to get in there and just be in it, because it was their only way of knowing how to deal with what was going on in terms of that, in terms of the fucking like Bush administration, like all that shit. So yeah, I don't doubt that he probably was not their normal drummer, but was supposed to be there for probably one or two groups that night.
Yeah, it just makes more sense. I mean, even Boston, which is so different from New York, I remember when I saw Eric Andre, like he had session musicians who came in to play his band, and they're like, "This is the easiest gig ever because they just want us to pretend." Like I thought I was gonna have to play this heavy stuff. Like I watched the show, and then it's just like, "No, you just pretend it's all tracked, but we need you here."
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, and I had a lovely conversation with those guys because they got there hyper early and I was like right up front to talk about the scene. So like it wouldn't surprise me, and especially the reaction from the bouncer of like, you're late. I get that that's a thing. And for somebody like, nobody wants to carry drums around in New York. Finding a drummer in New York is difficult.
Yeah, it's always the joke about those kids coming up from Jersey that have to pack all their shit into a van, right? Because like they have to lug their shit around like a, because they don't live in the city. The fucking apes.
One day, right now, we're just like Bon Jovi on the Pine Barrens, man. I don't know. But that is the question, and that satisfies me. That discussion of the idea that he is probably just a session musician, and then it really does feed into exactly what you're talking about with Meet Me in the Bathroom. Because, like, it could just be three guys who play instruments being like, hey, let's go up.
Yeah, and then what happens is that they like doing it enough together that they eventually form a band, and then they get fucking wrecked by the industry, which is the other half of that movie.
Which is the other half of every music story.
Yeah, yeah.
I watched the first two-thirds of the MC Hammer Behind the Music.
Seriously, you want to watch the fucking rise and fall of the Strokes. Like, check out Meet Me in the Bathroom. It's a phenomenal look at what happens after 9/11 and then how the industry comes in and kind of fucking wrecks it.
I'm not up for that after watching this movie.
Yeah,
but,
that's fair.
But I will definitely take note of it. When you mentioned it before, it was something that definitely interested me.
But I mean, but what's beautiful about the soundtrack of this film is that it works in that same regard, right? Like, as far as like the grief and the anger and all of that stuff, it's all present in all of the music that's here. It's just not about it. It does that thing that I applaud this movie for doing, and it doesn't use 9/11 as the center, the epicenter of its fucking like ripple effect that all people then feel, and we all have to deal with it. So the music is all going to be that too. Like, no, it's this idea that grief is something that has always existed, will always exist. We need to learn how to deal with it, and we still haven't. Like, the tragedy of grief is what this movie is all about, right? And that is present even in the soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad bastard music, to lift a phrase from High Fidelity.
Yeah, and it
is. And also, as somebody who just loves music and loves specifically soundtracks in general, the fact that almost every album that they talk about has a song featured from it.
Yeah.
Like, it is.
That's what I mean, is that, like, it feels very real, right? Because it's not that they, like, throw a record on and suddenly that's the song you hear, but they do mention the record, right? Yeah. So it's very cool that way.
And then, like, specifically the one that sticks with me is the first time we see him use his iPod in therapy. He puts on a Jackson Browne song, and, like, Jackson Browne has not been brought up prior to that point.
Yeah.
And it's, like, awesome. Excellent, because this is that like make or break moment. But then when he puts on Rain Over Me, it like makes sense, because that is Quadrophenia is what changed his life.
Yeah
they earn it. They earn every freaking moment.
Good stuff, man.
Yeah, it is. I was really surprised by this film. Which is what brings us to the final part of every episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, when we determine whether or not this film is part of our ASCU. Do you want to jump right in there, Siege? Or
yeah, I mean, it's not like it's just not for me. I adore this movie. Clearly, we've talked about it now for the last 2 hours. What all the reasons that I do. I don't think that it means anything, you know, more or less about this film to say that it just doesn't, it's not part of the Sandler verse. It does not have the Sandler oeuvre, the Sandler stink on it that these other movies do.
I agree on every level. Everything that you're saying is correct. It is, it's weirdly the main reason why I'm against it, because I kept finding examples like Don Sutherland's character as the judge who just sees through the bullshit and calls them out on the fact that, like, this is a petty fucking squabble and you're wasting taxpayer time on it.
Yeah.
Shut up. Get the fuck out of here. Leave Mike Binder at home. He's been in enough of this movie.
No more for you.
And I'm like, you Kiefer Spahn, son of a bitch.
Yeah.
but it's
funny because the amount of Sandler movies that end in courtroom scenes, we should definitely tally that up someday, right?
Yeah. It is, or star in courtroom scenes, right? That's My Boy is the first time that I really noticed this particular trope in an Adam Sandler film. Also, like, it's not in the ASCU. Siege and I have pretty much already ruled that it's not in the ASCU. But those giant McDonald's flags
in
the opening, it's like, Oh man, maybe it is. Maybe, but at
I
the
think
end.
that's more though. I think that in a Sandler movie, that would mean somebody paid some big money for that. In this movie, for I'm sure that somebody still paid money, but it feels like what the filmmaker then does is using it as this ironic kind of State of America 5 years later thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That this is these are the flags that we fly
Yeah.
in it. I want to address one other thing, and that is the footage that he is watching before he goes and buys the whiskey and then almost like attempt suicide. That's live footage, right? Like that's stuff that's going on in the city currently at the time.
As opposed to
Like he's not doom scrolling 9/11 footage. That's
no, I
New
mean, first
York
of all,
One's news that night,
no,
right?
yes, it is. And I think it's the realization that the world has not gotten better. You know, he's ignored the world for so long. He gets this, he maybe is kind of it's breaking this immersion that somehow the world has healed and he hasn't. And he opens his eyes and realizes, nope, everybody else is still just as fucked up as me.
Yeah, because I remember being in the city in March. I don't think it was this year. I think it was 2008. And there being a whole bombing thing going on in Times Square while I was there. And it just be like, this is like, that was the most sobering moment in this movie, is how 5, 6 years removed from 9/11, that was still what they were talking about in New York, because the threats, they didn't just stop. It wasn't like one big thing.
No, I mean,
Fear
remember they found like
became.
that van that was full of explosive material that they luckily put a stop to. I mean, you know, we had the guy with the shoe over in the UK, right? Like
Yeah.
they were this kind of shit just kept on going, and I mean, still does, right? Like we still are feeling the effects of this shit.
Yeah. And
The
it's.
one thing I do have my notes that I do think is worth pointing out. I forgot about this for a it I it's just too on the nose and kind of goes hand in hand with everything that you've said about this movie, but I mean. For an event in history that is literally remembered by the term "never forget," to have the whole thing be about a character that is refusing to remember is a move, is a choice. Yeah, so that's the kind of movie this is. If you have gotten to this point and not watched this film, what are you doing? But yeah, that's the kind of movie that this chooses to be.
But it is. It's even though there is found family, even though there's a smart judge, even though we finally get the mom from A Christmas Story after getting Darren McGavin all the way back in Billy Madison, there's just something about this movie that doesn't quite gel with the ASCU. And honestly, the big thing I hang my hat on is the Madison 23 of it all. Even if this film followed all of the tropes of an Adam Sandler film, even if Adam had been involved in the script in some way, shape, or form, the fact that he would want to put it out under something other than Happy Madison seems sort of like word of God, word of author, word of creator, that this is not meant to fit with the other toys in your toy box.
Right. I mean, he goes out of his way to space this one out from the rest of his work. He and if that is the initial word, I can only start from there, right? And
Yeah.
I and there's not enough in this movie to bring it back.
Right. Even though, I mean, there is. I would love BJ Novak to be the sniveling freaking Smithers to Eric Gordon in the movie, but it's just
Someday.
not gonna
There's
happen.
plenty of more movies in Sandler's future where BJ Novak can definitely show up.
And that is the thing that I will take away as the silverining
I
of
mean, we had
Rain
Mindy
Over
Kaling
Me.
and Funny People, didn't we? Did we not?
No,
Oh man, was she
Mindy
not?
Kaling is not in that movie.
It feels like she should have been.
Well, you're thinking of The Night Before, I think, if we're
Nice.
thinking about Seth Rogen and Mindy Kaling featuring films. All right, so now that we have done the deed with Rain Over Me and we have determined where it lands on our star charts of our Adam Sandler cinematic universe, it's time to look forward. It's time to look ahead. And I'd like to start this off by thanking all of the people who have been reaching out with their suggestions. Season 4 is for the fans. And after we've consulted all of the suggestions and, tallied the votes and all of that, Seijin decided that he's also going to put his thumb on the scale because October is his birthday months. I didn't know that men in their 30s got birthday months, but that's the world that we live in. And honestly, I couldn't think of a nicer guy to celebrate for the entire month of October. So I can definitely say, you know, to some of you, thank you for reaching out. I don't think you're going to be disappointed with this decision. Seijin, why don't you tell them what we're watching in October?
The Walt Disney classic, Bedtime Stories.
That's right. Yeah. That is right. This is...
Sandler Dunn made a Disney movie, and we're going to figure out what the hell happened there.
This is where Disney put Adam Sandler in the chair and sucked out all his Marvel ideas from working on Rain Over Me. And that's why the receptionist was the MIT vice chancellor in Spider-Man No Way Home. Again, that's why Donna Remack, Saffron Burroughs, winds up in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's why Don Cheadle, they were going to have him play Falcon because of his, why is he going to wear this green deep V plunge outfit? He was going to be Falcon, but then, you know, they're like, yeah, he's a little older. Why don't we make him Rhodes? It is. And why Liv Tyler was dating the Hulk in that one episode of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is when Disney got their hooks into Adam and took all of his good ideas. No, I don't want to believe that, but it is. It's Bedtime Stories, and I'm excited. I'm excited to rewatch this movie. This is the rare one of the for the fans that have actually seen.
Yeah, man. This is going to be an interesting experience for me because I've been on a very big Disney kick lately with watching Big Dudes, Little Kid movies. So, like, you know, The Pacifier and The Game Plan and that sort of shit. And so it's weird because it feels like it falls more into that than anything else, even though I wouldn't call Sandler one of the big dudes, but we'll see.
Yeah, but what we're going to determine is, while it's under the banner of the House of Mouse, can it also coexist in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe?
Oh my god, it's going to open up a whole other world if it does. A whole new world.
With dazzling sights I've never known. I messed that up, but it's because I was coughing.
Yeah.
Seijin, it's because I'm way up here. It's crystal clear.
All right.
That now I'm under the sea.
Can we kill this darling and move on?
Yeah, we can kill this darling. See, now we both said something kind of insensitive in the Rain Over Me episode. Look at that. So Bedtime Stories is on Disney Plus, right? Letting people know where they can check it out. I imagine since it's a Disney film that it's on Disney Plus.
Let me confirm that you send us away.
Excellent. So thank you so much for joining us in the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. We love to hear from you. Again, this season is for the fans. So if there is a movie that we haven't yet covered, go back through the archives, see what we've covered so far. And if there's something you don't see there that you'd like for us to cover in November or in December, send us a message on Twitter at the ASCU. Mm-hmm. If you specifically have also been watching Big Guy, Little Kid movies on Disney and would like to talk with Seijin about that a little bit, he can be found directly on Twitter at Siege versus the World.
And if you've been watching Big Kid, Little Guy movies, you can be behind Devin at Devin D. Decker.
I'm not.
And I am currently watching Bedtime Stories as we speak, by the way. It is definitely streamable on Disney Plus right now.
Excellent. That's fantastic. Don't send me that Wayans Brother movie where the guy is pretending to be a baby.
Little Man, literally called Little Man. They weren't that creative.
I did not want to say it for fear of if I said Little Man three times, it might summon him into the studio. I don't have time to deal with that. If you've enjoyed this, if you've enjoyed the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, and you would like to hear Seijin and I go way broader than the singular topic of Adam Sandler, we do that other podcast, The Say Report, and that drops new episodes every single Monday, and that can also be found wherever podcasts are found. But until next time, thank you so much for stopping by, and just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good one, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.